Hello everyone, it's Friday the 13th of May and welcome to episode 105 of the Kite Podcast with me, Will Evans.
And me, Ben Eagle, yes, the 13th, lucky for some. Climate change and carbon is on the podcast agenda again today as we focus in on the Climate Change Committee, which was established under the Climate Change Act in 2008. The committee's role is to advise the UK and devolved governments on emissions targets and report to Parliament on progress made in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and adapting to the impacts of climate change. Who better to have on the show, therefore, than the committee's chair, Lord Deben, or John Gummer, as he will be better known to many of you farmer listeners out there. Lord Deben was Secretary of State for the Environment from 1993 to 97, and then Secretary of State for Agriculture, Fisheries and Food from 1989 to 1993. We're also joined this morning by Kite's Managing Partner, John Allen, Kite's Head of Sustainability, Rachel Madeley-Davis, our podcast producer and Senior Kite Consultant, Becky Leach, and as always, by everybody's favourite dairy market analyst, Chris Walkland. We really do have a full house today. Chris, let's go over to you for the Milk Market Report. Where are you this week?
Well, with Lord Deben on the show, there's only one place I can bring my report from, and that's from the front room of where I used to live some 30 years ago, in a little hamlet called Hemley, near Newbourne, which is actually on the River Deben. And I have to say, you have taken as your lordshipnessness title the name of a fabulously beautiful place with wonderful scenery, amazing wildlife, majestic skies. I haven't been back for a few years, but I was at the lovely Ramshole Arms not long ago.
Oh, a brilliant, brilliant place, Chris.
Yes. But I have a complaint, Lord Deben, about the River Deben. And since you were my MP once and I never complained, now I feel able to do so today. You've got to do something about all that mud. There's too much of it. I mean, have you been for a paddle down at Ramshole recently? Anyway, when I was there, I was a young fledgling journalist, agricultural journalist, and you were my first Minister of Agriculture, and you made a huge impression. But back then, Her Majesty's Cabinet was a sensible, orderly place. It was a supposedly rather bossy lady keeping everyone in charge. A bit like Becky in this podcast.
I'm sweet.
Nothing wrong
only
with that.
Only the newspapers were mad back then. But now, 30 years on, both the media and the cabinet are both mad together. Anyway, to the markets. And for a quick roundup of what's been going on. And we can't have an eminent politician on the show and do a market report without doing it in the only language politicians really understand, and that's that of the election night poll special, complete with our very own swingometer. So here goes, with some silly accents thrown in, courtesy of Michael Gove and his wobbling head this week. If you haven't seen his interview, make a point of doing so. So here goes. And we bring our first result of the morning all the way from the constituency of Down Underland, where the ruling Fonterra Party has lost 20 seats, sorry, cents off its forecast milk price for the season. Its midpoint price is down to $9.30, equal to 36 and a half pence. That's a disappointing result for the candidate, but much in line with the exit polls. Next, and we're going across to Europe, and our reporter-in-chief, Mr. Gove. As the feedback from the Trader Vox pops was that there would be a further decline in prices. Traders have been talking the market down, hoping for a huge swing on the swingometer, but well,
I'm not sure about that one.
Move.
I'm confused where we're at now.
I know. We do.
With this government, that's a normal circumstance.
Anyway, enough of Gove. But yes. While the needle has moved, it hasn't moved a lot. And butter is still polling around 6,950 euros to 7,000 euros. That's a good price at this time of year. Now it's breathtaking over to the futures, the butter futures in Europe, where the swingometer has turned negative again and prices have dropped a touch. But that's nothing to what's happened down under. And the futures there, or as Gove would say, as the futures there, as they're tinked by 1,000 dealers. And there is now a 40% differential between EU and New Zealand prices. That's a phenomenal differential. But also tanking is the euro against the dollar. And we've got to watch these currency situations. Now on to powder. And the candidate for the European Research Group for skim milk powder is up against the monster raving loony skim milk powder party, but it's impossible to tell those two apart. They're both equally bonkers. But there's a gain there. Skim milk powder is about the same as it was, 3,900 euros. And that's a gain a bit, I think. Exactly as I predicted last week, except the price is up, not down. I think that we'll now go to the first result from the United Kingdom, and this is one to watch from Northern Ireland. But it's an exit poll. Let's throw our dollies out the pram on the protocol party. There is in for a landslide. And this is a serious issue that's come on the radar this week. There could be a trade war with the EU over the protocol. It's looking ever more likely, I'm afraid. And last but not least, because we're stretching the joke out a bit too much, we'll go to the first result for GB. Let's go live. Chris Walkland, the returning officer for the constituency of the Kite podcast, declare the following results, all in sterling. The lovely creamy butter party is 5,850. That's pretty similar to last time, so a decent result. The dollop of cream on your strawberries party is 255 to 265. Again, a little change on last week. And the Liz Truss, did you know we're producing more varieties of cheese than the French party? It's £4,700 for mild cheddar, £4,950 for mature, and £4,500 for Mott's. So those have all increased nicely again this week. And finally, the spot market, 35 to 40, quite a wide range there, but still pretty good for flush week, which we're in now, I think. So there we are. Good results this week for everything, considering some increases, some dips, but they could be a lot worse, and some stability and a strong outlook. So that's it. It's now over to my fellow podcaster, Tears, and our esteemed chairman of the Climate Change Committee to chew the cud on cows and carbon. Or to abbreviate the above sentence, it's over to our esteemed C, from the CCC to see the C on CNC. See ya.
thank you, Chris. And I'm wondering if I can get hold of some of whatever you and Michael Gove have both been taking. John, a few of the Kite team met with Lord Deben earlier this week. What was the purpose of that meeting?
Yeah, well, thanks very much. And thank you, Lord Deben, for coming on the podcast. It's a great pleasure to have you here and be interrogated. So we will see. Anyway, the reason for our meeting was a report that we published today called Project Apollo. Apollo being the god of truth and prophecy. So we were talking in this report about the fact that we are concerned about the fact that potentially policymakers might start to make the wrong decisions about the balance between nutrition and sustainability. And on that basis, you know, dairy is a fantastic nutritional product. And if we go the wrong direction, we could push our industry into contraction at a time when the world needs more food, particularly now when you see what's happening with food security. So it seemed a good time to actually share that report with Lord Deben and some other industry leaders. And we did that earlier in the week. And it's fantastic that Lord Deben's come on today to actually tell us a little bit more about his views on the future. And we've also got Rachel here. So I'm going to step back. And if you do want to read the report, it's going to be accessible via the website and it'll be issued today. Thank you very much. Lord D, it's over to you.
Well, thanks, Joel. Lord Deben, yes, thank you for coming on the show this morning. John's already introduced you as chair of the Climate Change Committee. Can you tell us a bit about the committee and its purpose and objectives, please?
Well, we were set up 13 years ago under the Climate Change Act, which was a cross-party act. It was invented by the Conservative Party in opposition, and they got the rest of the opposition parties on side, even the Protestant Unionists from the north of Ireland. Everybody was on side, and then they went to the Labour government and said, we've got 100 Labour members who will vote for this if we put it forward. But we want it to be cross-party, so we want the government to put it forward. So, in fact, that's what the government did. And it was passed with only 8 people voting against it. And of those 8 that are still alive, they're still against it. So you can see they really, there they are. Anyway, the result was the Climate Change Committee, which is now being copied all around the world, although nobody has really done the very tough thing that we did, which was to say, you've got to find some way of linking democracy, which means that you regularly have to update the mandate, and fighting climate change, which means that you can't regularly change the policy. You've actually got to have a permanent policy if we're going to win. So that what has happened is that the Climate Change Committee sets 5-year budgets for us to meet in order to reach what is now net zero. We started with 60% reduction. That became clearly not enough. Then 80%. And now we have to get rid of all our emissions, which we don't sequestrate, which is what net zero means. That is our aim. And we set the targets well in advance, 5-yearly gobbit, so to speak, but well in advance. So we're now up to the end of 2038. And that means that there is a proper framework in which government and business can operate. When we set the targets, Parliament debates them and then passes them. I say then passes them because they have passed all 6 that we have presented. And once they're passed, they can't be changed. And this is the very important difference from any other legislation. They can't be changed without the Climate Change Committee, the coming and giving permission. Now, the Climate Change Committee is non-party political. It has 8 or 9 members, and they are all senior economists or climate scientists. They are all academics, people who actually know about these things. That's unusual in this government. And there we are. So you actually give advice. Now, the thing that happened was that the first chairman, whom the prime minister of the time didn't much want because he was very independent, the first chairman set the example by making sure that we really did get a reputation throughout the world for being accurate, for not being a campaigning organisation, but for being a factual organisation. Our job was to tell people the truth. And it is true that in those 13 years, the great efforts of the climate change deniers, nobody's ever been able to undermine the science upon which we base what we say. So we do that. And we do not follow fashion. We try to say what we think is right on the facts. And we never over-egg it. So we will always be likely to err on the side of accuracy as against likelihoods.
Yeah.
And so that's what we do. And then every year in June, we assess how far the government has met the targets which it has accepted as law. And of course, if the government doesn't meet them in the end over a period of time, they'll be in the courts, because by law they have to do that. That's what the system is. And indeed, they're in the courts at the moment by Cool Earth and one or two other organisations in order to try to say, look here, Client Earth, you haven't done what you said you've done. Now, we wouldn't take them to court, but I am likely to be the first witness for the prosecution. So it's kind of a difficult role to play. So that's what it is. I'm the only non-scientist on the committee, and my job is to try to make sure that we always speak the language of the public, which is a thing I feel very strongly about. That's why I've banned the phrase kilowatt hour. I don't know what it means. I can't smell it. I can't touch it. So you've got to talk about people's bills, because that's what people do understand and what I understand. Yeah. So if I don't understand it, I insist upon it being rewritten so that I do understand it. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a lot to be said for having a non-scientist questioning scientists, because you very often ask the most difficult questions because they have to come back to basics, which is, after all, what the public thinks.
For sure. And what about delivery on the findings of the committee? How do you ensure that information follows through the system?
Well, we badger the government and it does it. And in general, the government has accepted the policy. I mean, we cannot complain about this government in the sense that it has set the targets which are necessary to reach net zero. It asked us, could we reach net zero? How much would it cost and when could we do it by? We gave them that information. They now know that it won't cost a lot. It costs less than 1% of our gross national product. The real problem is that the cost falls in uncertain ways. It doesn't, and it also falls on some people more than others, some industries more than others. So the government has to intervene in order to have a fair transition. But the total cost is certainly well within our ability to pay. And it may be, I happen to think it will be, it may be that it won't cost us anything, because what this is really doing is creating new jobs and also meeting the requirements which, having woken up from our dream, we've discovered that there's a thing called a European war, that we don't have food security and we don't have energy security. And therefore, what we have to do for climate change is actually what we're going to have to do anyway, because what we have to do for climate change is to make sure that we are more productive as far as food is concerned, and that we are secure as far as energy is concerned, which is using our own energy opportunities, like offshore wind, which is now, apart from onshore wind, the cheapest way of generating electricity, because we invested in it, because the government actually set it off. The problem with governments are that they're very bad at delivery. So they've got the policy right, they've got the aims right, they've got some of the broad mechanisms, but in the end, what we have to press them for is a delivery body and a proper delivery. We want the same kind of delivery that delivered the COVID vaccination. That's what we need, because it is by far the most urgent thing that we face, even more so than COVID.
Rachel, can we bring you in here now and sort of bring it towards dairy specifically? I mean, Will mentioned earlier on that several members of the Kite team met earlier this week to discuss really the role of dairy when it comes to tackling climate change and critically adapting to a changing climate. Can you just give us a summary of that discussion?
Yes. No. Do you know, it was a fantastic sort of day. It really was. I feel really privileged to be part of it. And I think the key thing was, is actually all those key stakeholders in that room saw it as completely pre-competitive. It is that big, this is pre-competitive. And actually reflecting what Lord Deben's just said, it's time for perhaps, it's action, isn't it? Stop talking and actually it's about action. And actually what we did in that sort of room is we talked about actually what has UK Dairy already done? And also sort of, and what is it doing currently? And also what will it be doing? And using those sort of areas, we then started to see actually, you know, sort of what were the key learnings, you know, what worked, what didn't work, and actually what are the barriers going forward? And more importantly, how can we overcome those barriers to get there. So it was a really productive day in terms of analysing our position, but actually thinking about some of the really good work we have already done as well, which I think is important, but actually appreciating that there's still a lot more we need to do.
And yeah. I thought that one of the things then, Lord D, you can come back in, is that you really put it to us that we're not very good at communicating what we are doing, are we? That was the message I took from you, certainly. Is that fair?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think my comment was that you've really got to act as an industry. I mean, I quite agree about the pre-competitive situation, but you've also got to act as an industry. And the simple point that I pointed out was that I was in my local co-op doing a bit of shopping for the weekend, and went to the butter counter, and there were all these different butters. None of them explained properly why I should buy one rather than another, and none of them carried the sort of slogans which you ought to be carrying, which is that this is fresh butter produced from British, if this is true of a particular butter, fresh butter produced from British farms on British grass. This is full grass-fed butter. I mean, all the things that you can talk about and remind people about this all the time. Instead of that, you have sort of anonymous packaging, which may say made in Wiltshire or made in Scotland or whatever. It may just say that. It doesn't engage the customer. And it's very difficult to know. I mean, so why? What do people do? They buy by price or by memory. They've had, say, Kerrygold or Anchor, or they've had Muller, or they've had somebody else's, and therefore they buy it, or they buy it entirely on the basis of price. You ought to be selling it all. I mean, really selling it. This is a business, and I don't think you sell it enough. And there's a very good story. The butter industry has returned from the old days of being told that it was dangerous for us, and people taking what my father used to think to be a ridiculous concept. He said, "Well, there can't be a choice," he said. A properly made natural product against something that's made out of a whole lot of chemicals and you don't know what it is and it's all stirred up somewhere. Said, I'm not in favour of that. I much prefer to have butter. And so we always had butter. So that's why we're reasonably healthy as a family. So I'm very keen on selling it. But we do live in a vulgar world. This is a world in which you have to sell things. And I don't think we are selling it enough, selling the health product enough, pointing out that it's an important part of a mixed nutrition. And the same is true of milk. I mean, why on earth we have allowed people to get away with false milk? First of all, I don't think they should be allowed to call it milk because it isn't milk. It's a white liquid created in order to pretend it's milk. And much of it is environmentally extremely unfriendly. I mean, almond milk, nobody should drink, because almond milk comes from almonds, which are very, very much endangering the water supplies in most of the places they're grown. This is not an acceptable kind of thing. The only milk that is acceptable in that sense is oat milk. That you can argue with. But the nutritional issues then have to be raised. And I am concerned that people are misled. That's why I don't think you should be allowed to be called a sausage without meat isn't a sausage. Bacon comes from a pig. It does not come from a laboratory. And it should say very clearly what it is.
Yeah.
One of the things your industry has been bad at doing is insisting that the language is not misleading.
Just cutting in there, one thing that you said there, which I think was absolutely critical in that, sorry, is that just a few words, there is a good story here. And actually telling that story is absolutely vital. And I mean, it's all part of a process. But Rachel, perhaps linking on to that, a lot of the last year on the podcast, when it comes to the climate conversation, we've been talking about the theory, we've been talking about GWP 100, GWP Star, and how that relates. But actually, what Monday was really good at, as you were saying, was actually focusing on what has been achieved so far. So I wonder if you could just summarise that, but also say critically, what do we still need to do now? What is the action that people need to do on the ground?
Yeah, and it probably links back to that telling the story, really, isn't it? So we're not very good at actually saying what we have done so far. So you think, you know, we're 10 years into the dairy roadmap now, and actually there's some big headlines. And, you know, thinking about water, you know, we've improved water quality and water usage on farms. You know, we've improved our energy efficiency on UK dairy farms. We're managing our waste much better, productivity. So there's all these real sort of tangible elements just at farm level. But I think that Lord even touched on the key bit here, and actually what we'll talk about is nutrients. And actually it's about overlaying that carbon factor and carbon emissions factor with the nutrients that ruminants produce. And actually it's almost it's an argument that gets forgotten quite a lot. We focus so much on that carbon impact and actually forget that why we're producing it, why we're consuming it. We're consuming these goods for nutrients. And everything we consume has a carbon impact. But actually, if we look on the ratio of what we're getting from it versus that, then actually there's a brilliant story to tell. However, I'm not naive, and I think we can always do better. And I think anyone who doesn't think they can't do better is probably had their, you know, head under a rock or what have you, because we can always strive to do better, and we must. And I think the key is, I mean, we've sort of estimated that roughly about 42% probably of UK dairy farmers are currently conducting carbon audits, which probably translates about 60% of the milk pool. But actually, there's still a lot more that needs to be done. There's a lot of farmers that aren't doing that. So it's actually, as an industry, how do we mop up and how do we reach those farmers that perhaps aren't engaged with this agenda at the moment? And I think that's our greatest challenge. But I certainly think that as an industry, we're really united, and actually we're game for that challenge and looking forward to how we really drive this agenda forward.
And just to follow up on that, Rachel, one of the pieces in the report which we've got and that Lord Deepin referred to is that for a kilogram of carbon, you get more nutrition out of dairy than you do out of any of the dairy alts. And one of the things we can't afford to, and so we really need to start to think about how we look at the balance between nutrition and sustainability. That doesn't obviate the need for the industry to do its bit and to take its responsibilities and actually reduce its environmental footprint. We've said all that, and we've said we can commit ourselves to a 30% reduction by 2030. My concern, and this is what I want to go back to the Lord Deepin about, is why as an industry do we we can't afford to wait 30 years like the butter industry for margarine to fall out of favor and butter come back. Lord Deepin, why is dairy getting such a disproportionate coverage, and also meat? Will's here, you know, in terms of this two legs good, four legs bad syndrome, or whatever we've got out there. What is going on in your view in terms of why the livestock industry is getting such a bad press?
Well, first of all, nobody listens to the moderate voice in the world of the media, and certainly the sort of social media. I mean, I'm fed up with being misquoted as far as the Climate Change Committee is concerned. We have said very simply that we need to eat about 20%, between 20 and 30% less meat, but eat better meat. And we've also said clearly better meat means British meat because it has the lowest carbon footprint of any meat in the world. And what we should not be doing is having feedlots and the kind of industrialized systems which don't do anybody any good. And we should be prepared to pay the price that it brings to have decent meat. That's a good story for the farmers, and it's a good story for your health. It's a lot less reduction than the more extreme health people say, but it's the right one for climate change. Now, I'm never quoted for that. Each side quotes the bit they like and not the bit they don't like. And this is bad on both sides, because if farmers sound as if they're not taking this seriously, I mean, there were some Welsh farmers, for example, who attacked the Pembrokeshire County Council, because the Pembrokeshire County Council dared to say to its workers, If you want to do something for the climate, then you should eat a little less meat. Now, I agree the Pembrokeshire County Council didn't tell the story in its full. The farmers then went at them saying this was outrageous and they shouldn't be using public money to do this. That wasn't what they should have done. They should have said, what a good thing. And what we mean is good meat grown in Pembrokeshire from natural production here in the spot with a low carbon footprint. That's what they should have done and taken it up in that way. And instead of that, they shouted at each other. And of course, nothing then happens. We don't deliver anything. So that's the first reason why it's so difficult to get people to be serious about it. The second thing is, the truth is that the climate change issue is absolutely vital, urgent, and central. And most people have understood that. And the more you look at what's going to happen if we don't do what we need to do, the more you realize just how serious it is. We've never been in a position in which human beings know that in their own hands is their own future in a real way. We either get this right or we do consign future generations to the end. It is a real choice. Now, in those circumstances, it is hugely important. And when people say it's hugely important, a lot of other people then decide that this is the way to promote their particular interest. So the vegans hang on to climate change and use it as a means of pressing veganism. They aren't vegans because of climate change. Well, some are, but very few. They aren't vegans because they're vegans because they're vegans. Now, I don't mind you being a vegan as long as I don't have to have the food. I don't mind you being a vegan at all. It's up to you to decide to be a vegan. But don't tell me that being a vegan is necessary for fighting climate change. It is the opposite. We need animals in order to regenerate the soil. You can't have the sort of proper farming which we need to recover without animals. And therefore, I object to vegans actually hijacking the climate change agenda for their reasons. I'm not hijacking their agenda. They can have it. I choose not to. But we should not be telling people that. So that's the second reason. I'm afraid it's a really sad thing that we find ourselves being caught up with other people's agendas. The last thing is this. We do live in an extremist world. When I was being brought up, my mother had a number of sayings which I found very boring at the time, but I think now were very sensible. And she would say, moderation in all things, and a little of what a few fancy does you good. I think both of those are extremely sensible concepts. Instead of that, in every way, we have gone to extremes. You only have to look at our politics. I mean, what kind of political choice was it between Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson? That isn't the political choice of moderate, sensible people. What kind of discussion did we have over Brexit, which was just an extreme shouting match at each other? We've become a nation, and I'm afraid increasingly a world, where people shoot to both ends. And I think your industry has a real chance of recapturing what I think most sensible people want. They know perfectly well that it's nice to have a chicken, but it isn't very sensible to poison the why. They know perfectly well that that is so. And we've got to help them make those choices. And in a time of rising cost of living, we have to recognize how difficult that's going to be. It is very peculiar to see chicken and beef at the same sort of price. Mm. And that is an aberration. But we don't make it better by saying to people that everybody has to have chicken all the time, and therefore we've got to produce them irrespective of the damage caused. We have to find a way of recovering a moderation, which this nation used to be known for and now isn't.
And talking of extremes, Lord Deben, and perhaps going back to this idea of different camps, encampments, and also reflecting on, I suppose, the process
of how you analyze your research, how you analyze the evidence. When it comes to thinking of things in silos versus the bigger picture, obviously we've got multiple different factors we're talking about, thinking about biodiversity loss, the economic climate, energy, food security. So when you're looking at your evidence, obviously you have these broader targets, quite specific targets, but how is that shaped around the broader picture?
Well, first of all, you have to have a very broad basis for the work that you do, because things intertwine, which is one of the troubles with government, because they have silos and they don't link together the things. So what happens in the Climate Change Committee is we are very, very determined of having a broad basis of the work that you do. So first of all, you have to cover the countryside, so to speak, and then you zero in on the particular issue. So if we were talking about cows, for example, you get to know that the methane produced by cows is an important issue which we have to do something about. You then are sensible and say, but that's the same as the methane produced by human beings. Let's stop hitting poor old cow as if he's the only methane producer. Although it is true that because of the way cows eat, they produce methane in a rather large extreme. So you have to accept that. So then you say to yourself, well, what do we need to do? Well, first of all, you want to concentrate on the cows that are least productive of that. Secondly, you've got to think about how you feed them in a way which reduces that and do the research on that. Thirdly, you say to yourself, if we can produce more milk from the same number of cows, then that's rather a good idea too. So you try to deal with disease. And that's why I'm such a huge fan of trying to get rid, for example, of mastitis, which is a thing we can get rid of now. So then you talk about engineering. You talk about genetic engineering to be able to do those things. And that we certainly could do. And all that brings you to higher productivity using less land and producing less methane. All that's sensible, but you have to bring it all together to get that. And you don't start there. You start with the broader picture and ask yourself how that all fits in. And then you have to say the cow has a huge amount of additional work to do, which is to make any sort of regenerative farming work. I'm to declare an interest because I farm a small farm organically. Without the animals, we don't think that we can do the organic farming properly. Now, I don't think all farming is going to be organic, but I think it's all going to be much more regenerative because we all know we're destroying the basis of our lives. We are destroying the soil, and unless we put the goodness back into it, we're not going to have future harvests. And cows, as well as other animals, play a big part in that.
Rachel, how does the industry itself, how does dairy itself ensure that we don't focus on climate impact in a silo separated from the biodiversity crisis or other sustainability challenges?
Yeah, no, this is something I've sort of gone about a lot, actually, and probably it's industry, but also policy as well. We need to stop focusing on things in silos. If you think about the climate crisis and the nature crisis, is they're intrinsically linked. And so therefore, we should never be looking at one without looking at the other at the same time. So I think obviously that there's some big policy issues here in terms of looking at it more holistically. But I think as farmers, you know, we're uniquely placed to actually feed into both of these things. We've got a bit of a gift, really, if you think about. And on top of that gift, we can also produce food. So actually, I think if you look at your land more holistically, your farms more holistically, and ensuring that policy drives through from government, but also via the retailers and the processors to ensure that we are looking at things in a much more, sorry, I use the word holistic way too much, but it's the only word I can really think of that reflects this, but actually seeing that we can't just have that focus on carbon. We've got to also focus on our management of the natural habitats and our farms because they benefit each other and they benefit our farms. And they make our farms more money. And actually, it makes the world a better place. So I think it's about changing the language, being more open, perhaps being challenging with one another, farmers sometimes, and really trying to drive that sort of mindset shift at farm level.
Lord Deben, I'm quite interested in asking this question, but you mentioned sort of extremist extreme voices, extreme messages, and different organizations sort of yelling at each other. And we all know about these sort of absurd culture wars that are going on at the moment. But you must get a lot of conflicting messages coming from different organizations or individuals submitting evidence, and I'm sure they're all very compelling. But how do you reconcile that? Where do you even begin with that?
Well, you have to start off with the principle that your job is to seek the truth. And therefore, you have to investigate the various messages very carefully. And you know perfectly well that people choose the bits of evidence that suit them and not other bits of evidence. So you need to have quite a lot of our expenditure is actually on original research. In other words, sometimes it's original in the sense that people haven't done it and we need to know. Sometimes it's original in the sense of looking at things that people have done and try to see whether it's actually accurate or not. Has it been properly peer-reviewed? Does that really stand up? And we're always honest when we change our assessments. And sometimes it's assessments which are about how people are going to react. I mean, I think we were less optimistic than we should have been about the uptake of the electric car. We didn't know that the electric formula was really going to make electric cars sexy, that Elon Musk was going to transform the market, all those things you don't know. So we thought the uptake would be slower. We were, on the other way around, we were more optimistic about heat pumps than we should have been, because the government has never really explained to people what it is, and most people don't know what a heat pump is, and all they know is that it's expensive and does it make a difference, don't know whether it makes a difference or not. So you have to admit that you have to do the best you can with the evidence that you've got. But the issue about the evidence is that it has to be true. Mm-hmm. And so when you are pressed by people, you ask them very tough questions. And as I say, there's a lot to be said for the tough questions which start right at the beginning. And I tend to do that because I want to know exactly what you mean when you say things. And I think very often we talk a language of our own. And I admit that in agriculture, you know, I fall into an agricultural conversation and then we all talk about things that we know about. And you say CAP reform has had this problem. Everyone never knows what CAP is. And then you have to explain to people that the CAP is not original, that we used to have a system of deficiency payments, which was practically the same in terms of its effort, what it did. And therefore, we have to talk about the fact that farmers have been, no farmer who is active today has ever lived in a situation in which there have not been production support. So for goodness sake, be sensible about the transfer of the present to the new. And this government has tried to do that without giving people a proper roadmap. And I think it's very difficult to be a farmer at the moment because I don't know what choices you make, because the government is not telling you inside which parameters you're going to work. And the reason they're not is that they don't know. And that makes it even worse. And I really do feel strongly about that. DEFRA does not have a route to net zero. I mean, Bayes has a route. It may say that it's not fully extended and that we need to have more evidence and all sorts of things, but it does actually have one. And DEFRA, which is the other ministry supposedly central to all this, doesn't have one.
Well, this question follows on quite nicely then, and we'll make this the last question. It's quite a big one, but can we ensure future food security while supporting the objectives of the Climate Change Committee?
Well, I think it's the other way around. I think we don't ensure future food security unless we take on the objective of the Climate Change Committee. Because the fact of the matter is, at the moment, we are creating food at the expense of future society. And we're doing that in two different ways. One is that we are not replenishing the soil, and we know that. And therefore, the people who tell us that we've only got 40 harvests to go. Right, it may not be 40, it may be 50, it might be 30. But the fact is, we are not replenishing the soil. And that's why regenerative farming has become so much a central matter. It's because if we're going to feed ourselves, if we're going to give ourselves a maximum amount of food from our own resources, then actually we've got to do that. And that is also something that will help us to sequestrate carbon, because carbon is a very necessary part of fertility. And you don't want your soil to fail to do that. And that's what we need as far as the climate change is concerned. And then we've also got to recognize that if farmers are going to do that, then they've got to be able to do that without being unfairly competed with by deals done by governments with other countries. And that's why the Climate Change Committee condemned the fact that both the agreement with New Zealand and that with Australia did not properly cover that. And the government did not do what it promised to do. That is the seriousness of this government, is that it doesn't do what it said it would do. Which is, for example, why one has to say that this argument about the Northern Irish Protocol is a scandal. The government signed up to it. Mr. Johnson praised it in the House of Commons. They are now shouting at the European Union and blaming it. The Union signed up to what was our compromise. We now find it's very difficult to do because the intransigence of the DUP in the north of Ireland means that they refuse to do anything else unless we do what they say. Now, the government really does have to stand up and say, we have signed it. We are prepared to discuss with the European Union to see if we can make it a bit better, because it does look as if it doesn't work as well as we hoped it would be. But we don't get there without shouting, and we're back in the shouting time. We've just got to stop that. But the same is true about promises about overseas agreements. We promised that the British farmer would be protected from being undercut by people who are not meeting the climate change demands. Now we've signed an agreement with Australia which says in 15 years' time, we will be undercut. And Australia is one of the most recalcitrant countries in the world on climate change. It is an unacceptable decision to make. And so my belief is that exactly what we demand from the climate change, by the Climate Change Committee, is what you need to do for the future. We have to grow more of our food at home. We have to protect ourselves from depending on other people, because we know what that dependence means. And that must be good for climate too, because we're not carrying stuff all over the place. We can grow an awful lot of this stuff much more effectively ourselves. We can renew our soils, and we can sequestrate the carbon which we put into the atmosphere. And we can lead the world in the kind of science which means that you can have cows which belch less. What a remarkably good thing to do. I know my mother would prefer not to talk about belching, but she would agree that that's the best way forward.
Yeah. Even in moderation, maybe.
As far as she was concerned, it was something that didn't happen.
Can I just say thank you very, very much, and so much common sense in such a short period of time. I'm a Tory party member. Can we actually get you back as Minister, please, for Agriculture, or maybe PM? Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. That's all we have time for today. But a very big thank you to our guests today, Lord Deben, John Allen, Rachel Madeley-Davis, Chris Walkland, and our podcast producer, Becky Leach.
Yes, thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next week. But for now, it's goodbye from all of us here.